Welcome to the Dialogue Book Report, where we discuss literature and arts of interest to LDS readers. I'm Andrew Hall, an editor at Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. And I'm excited to present a conversation among three of the LDS community's celebrated poets, each with recent collections exploring LDS religious and family themes. Zach Hutchins is a professor of literature at Colorado State University and is the author of Joseph and Epic, an epic poem chronicling Joseph Smith's early prophetic years, published by the University of Illinois Press. Besides several academic books, he's also the author of Shall I Have Pleasure, which examines the role of pleasure in LDS theology and experience. Lance Larson is the author of Making the Kingdom of It, a collection of poetry discovering divinity in life's everyday details. It is his sixth poetry collection. Lance is the former poet laureate of Utah and is currently the chair of the English department at BYU. And the whole discussion is being moderated by Elizabeth Garcia, who has been the poetry editor at both Sigilla and Dialogue in the past. And she introduces her own work, Resurrected Body, which examines women's experiences after childbirth, particularly the journey of reclaiming personal identity. So Elizabeth, take it away.
So I wanted to give you guys a chance to talk for a minute about your books, a little bit how you came to write it, what was kind of driving that. And then we'll get into some more nerdy questions about historicity and theology, things like that. So Zach, you want to start by telling us a little bit about your project?
Sure. And thank you so much, Liz, for that generous introduction and for the work that you're doing and bringing us together. I really appreciate this. Just as a little bit of background, this is a poem that's very much written in the epic tradition of Dante and Milton, it's self-consciously so. And that's a fairly long tradition in LDS literary tradition, right? From the earliest days of the Restoration, people have been interested in sort of putting the story of the Restoration in one form or another into epic poetry. I think there's some good reasons for that we could talk about. But for me, this project began as an idea more than 20 years ago now, when I was serving a mission in Brazil and listening to Truman Madsen's lectures on Joseph Smith. And as I was listening to those lectures, my head was filled with the wonder of what Joseph Smith had accomplished. And I imagined telling his story. It took me a long time to be able to even start it. But that was the genesis of the project for me. Over the course of the past 20 years, my conception of Joseph Smith has, I think, become much fuller, and I understand him not just as sort of the hero of the Restoration that I saw as a 19-year-old missionary, but as a human being and one who accomplished some amazing things and struggled through some really challenging times and had to wrestle with some fairly thorny questions. And I hope that the poem as it exists now, which covers sort of the first 11 years of Joseph's prophetic ministry from about 1819 to about 1830, reflects some of that more nuanced understanding that I've come to over the course of time.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Yes, I was impressed to read in your introduction that it took you 20 years. And of course, as a mom who wrote and didn't, you know, come out with my first full-length collection for 10 years, I was like, wow, okay, you beat me. 20 years is a long time.
You beat me. That is the real.
Right. Lance, would you like to share with us about your book and how that's kind of fallen into your career and how that fits the arc of your work?
Sure. First, a side note. My path crossed paths with, or I crossed paths with Zach for 3 years while he was at BYU. And this is an important detail. He plays basketball and has a very mean rim game. I felt very lucky
that we played together.
So anyway, excited. I've been the poems in this collection were written between 2018 and 2023. And in sort of an underwhelming way, what drove the collection was that they are not prose poems. I had just completed a prose poem collection and wanted to get back to the line, back to enjambment and white space and stanzas and all that cool poetic stuff. My usual approach for writing a collection is to write the best poem I can, then the next poem and others, workshop them and send them off and live with them for a while, sit with them and see which ones stand out. So the deliberate part of the process, which I take very seriously, comes later in the winnowing and in the arranging. So I'm not ever sure quite what I'm going to have. So it's really that portion of the project is collage-like. I see what's out there and realize that I have 40 or 50 poems and that I could arrange them in, I don't have the algorithm for this, but, you know, hundreds of thousands of ways. And I'm just trying to find one that will hold water, so to speak. So that's how it came to be. In retrospect, though, I see that these poems are probably more celebratory and God-inflected than earlier collections. I studied with a poet at University of Houston named Adam Zagajewski, who wrote a poem titled "Try to Praise the Mutilated World," which was on the inside back cover of the New Yorker the week after 9/11.
Oh,
and
my.
It's a very apropos poem for anybody who has read that black issue. You look at it in the front, there's nothing there, and then you turn it and you can see the two buildings come up, and so they appear and disappear. He wrote that poem a year and a half before 9/11. So it's a very prescient poem.
Right.
I hope that my collection is doing something like that, trying to praise an imperfect and broken world. Maybe that's what poets always do, but that poem is on my mind, and so I can sort of recalibrate that collection, looking backwards, I suppose, to be a collection of celebration in the face of tragedy and difficulty and so forth.
Yeah, it's interesting that you wrote over that time period that covers COVID, but I didn't really notice, well, you have the sacrament in your garage, so there's like the nod to COVID, but there wasn't a lot directly about that. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I'm assuming that you must have had some, but maybe they didn't make it into the collection.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know that I had that many COVID poems that referenced it directly. Maybe there are a few and they didn't make it in. That's a good question. I haven't really thought about it in those terms.
Yeah. Well, I was interested to hear you talk about just the winnowing process. I tend to be kind of impatient in trying to finish things because I had this long period of time where, you know, I'm raising my kids and I would write a little bit and then take a hiatus. I couldn't write when I was pregnant or had little kids. And so now I'm back in grad school and now I can finally get to what I want to do. And I have like four projects that I'm working on at the same time and wanting to have spent so much time on them. I do get very impatient for, let me get this out in the world, but I need to spend time. And then it's also fun too, to look back at something and go, oh, I have a different vision for this. And you follow that instinct to how that might manifest. So send that. And then, okay, now I get to talk about mine a little bit, I guess, which is funny. I didn't even bring a copy of my book. That was so silly of me. My book is about how do you recover your identity after you have become a mother? And there's often kind of a period of time where you're in your cave. You have to lose yourself a little bit. And the struggle of how to not do that, especially in a culture not necessarily just a Mormon culture, but in a Christian culture where we're taught to, we should aspire to be martyrs. We should aspire to lose ourselves in order to find ourselves. And I definitely have a soapbox about the dangers of that, especially for women who tend to put themselves last anyway. And so my collection is trying to explore that witness to that that phenomenon, but then also how can someone find life again, find their role, find creativity, even in the midst of serving your children and raising them, and how much, you know, of course, we can learn from them. So that's what mine deals with. And again, it did take me about 10 years to work on. I didn't even write any poems about my children until much later. It was a slow thing, I think, because I didn't know yet how to write about domestic issues in a way that wasn't overly sentimental. I think that I've gotten much better about that. And so it was finally a way that I could, write about home and children, but still address the really rough parts and not shy away from that. So
you do a beautiful job, Liz.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. I've been fortunate to have several friends who have read it and tell me, oh, I don't really like poetry, but I like yours. I'm like, yay, my mission is accomplished. So I would like to start by asking you both a little bit about historicity and how that shows up in your texts. Of course, Zach, obviously, since you're writing about Joseph, who is a historical character, but also someone that we as LDS acolytes look to and have a fair sense of orthodoxy about how we perceive his role. And so I wanted to ask you to talk about the times where you were fictionalizing and making things up versus what you really wanted to stick to in terms of being true to the historical record. And how did you make some of those choices? Maybe give us some examples and what were some of the challenges for that with you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the way that I would answer it is to say that in thinking through the relationship between history and literature within a faithful context, I feel as though we have some great models in the scriptures. We tend to think of and read the Bible as in a Protestant literalist tradition, but if you're a careful reader of the Bible, there are plenty of places where the text sort of signals to you that it is doing things fictionally. Scholars of the Bible point to, say, the Book of Job, where you have this prose frame tale that's framing the poetic dialogue between Job and his friends, and the entire work is pretty self-consciously literary. Now, that doesn't mean that Job wasn't a historical figure or that Job didn't have these challenges. But the larger point is that whoever authored the Book of Job thought that the best way of getting at the truth of his circumstances was not a dry accounting of Job, of Job's life particulars, but a literary retelling that dramatized and helped us to see the subjective experience of being Job. And that's really the goal in Joseph, is to delve into some of those interpersonal dynamics and revelatory experiences where whatever the historical record, we just don't have access to the subjective experience of what it is like to be confronted with a theophany, the experience of seeing God, what it is like to be in a marriage where the marriage project, in some sense, takes a back seat to divine commission. And so, you know, for me, I think the place where I felt that most keenly was in the relationship between Joseph and Emma, as I was trying to think through, you know, what it meant for those two people to be partners, not just in a an interpersonal project, but in a salvific project. And to imagine some of the conversations that they had about what it meant to be married. You know, marriage in the 19th century was largely an economic contract, but this was something far more beyond the romantic or the feelings that they had for one another. And so, you know, I think that my goal in addressing these historical figures was to help myself and help readers think beyond what the historical record can capture, because we just don't have a whole lot of documentation about like what Joseph and Emma's relationship was, especially in the early years, or what it was like for Joseph to go through the death of his brother Alvin, say, as he's struggling with what it means to be a prophet and who he can rely on and what the Lord's told him about those things. So that was the hope, and you know, hopefully the project reflects, you know, some of those new perspectives on matters that aren't captured in the historical record.
Yeah, and I appreciated in your introduction where you kind of address that, you know, that you're going to be dealing with polygamy, and that you recognize that that issue has been a real thorn for a lot of church members, and that you kind of wanted to, you know, address it and also acknowledge that that's a issue. And yeah, so much of what you just said about, you know, the paradigms that we have coming to church history, I think personally have been really helpful to me to come at it from an academic perspective. I was listening to, of course, because Come Follow Me this week is about polygamy, and Faith Matters has used several podcast episodes about different historical views of it and personal views. And then I also listened to the Follow Him podcast where they were talking about, you know, this issue, and hearing some of the personal accounts from women who chose to participate in it. I think it was so helpful for me to get that really huge overview. And so, yeah, taking a creative approach, I think can be really helpful in looking back at history and examining kind of that those gaps of what we don't know, and how we might create a literary retelling. And actually, I'm going to hop over to another question I had for Lance, since I feel like this is relevant. Your book is called Making a Kingdom of It. And I was really struck with the concept there, especially as it appears in the poem that's like the title poem, in which it seems to me that this creation of this book, and it, you know, making a poem is a made thing, is then kind of being implied that there's a parallel with how we create our own personal theology, that, you know, like Zach, you mentioned that maybe it works better to use a literary retelling of Job's story, making it into an art object, because that, as we kind of interpret the meaning of that, that is the best vehicle for understanding the principles. And so I just thought it was interesting that that Lance, your approach to the way that you frame your collection kind of implies that idea of how do we create our own personal theology by picking and choosing and kind of winnowing our own experiences. So I don't know, did you want to maybe talk about that and your kind of thematic overview of this book, since we're talking about this?
Yeah, Sure, I can say a few things about it. So that poem came fairly early in the process, and it was uncharacteristically short, which pleased me to no end. If I can write something sonnet length or shorter, I'm always happy. It landed in a good journal, and I tried out various titles. You know, I always have a working title for a collection and then shift it around. And then at a certain point, I thought, well, this title is telling a larger story that could easily apply to this collection. So I tried it out and brought in other titles, and this one just won out in the end. And I suppose a title serves as a particular lens, which helps you see not only the overall arc of a collection, but how individual poems feed that narrative. And it seemed that was one way to create that deliberateness, that when we're given difficult situations. Earlier, you referred to a poem about the pandemic, and in the same poem, there's dementia, mm-hmm. And my in-laws. So it seemed to me that that's what poetry is always doing, and what we're doing in our own lives is we take these stark, recalcitrant, imperfect materials, and we make something of them. And so that's essentially the device that I used.
Yeah, and it's really well done. Later, I think I'll have you read possibly Quail Egg, which is comes at the end of the poem, and I think kind of rounds out this idea of what exactly we're making. I was going to also ask you in terms of historicity, Lance, and I guess I was curious about this because in my graduate class, I had this experience where a friend was reading her poem in a workshop, and I responded to her as if assuming that the speaker, the I, was really her. And she said, "Oh, I just made this all up." And my response was, "Well, you did what?" I know there are Prosoda poems. I mean, I've written those. But I realized that I had kind of this assumption that if someone sounds like they're talking about their real experience, it must be real. And so I had to kind of step back a little and go, okay, I should not always be assuming that the I or the speaker is saying something that actually happened. So I just wanted to ask you about that. What is your take on that? Do you sometimes just completely fictionalize an experience, or do you always rely on memory and try to be true to your life experience? Maybe what do you teach your students about that? What would you like to share about? What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So a poet I grew enamored of in graduate school is Philip Levine. I still very much admire his work, but for those who are not acquainted, he's a Detroit poet or an urban poet, blue collar and so forth. But his stories are larger than life. And one assumes, because of the authenticating detail, that they're entirely autobiographical. Not so.
Okay.
In an interview, he said, what he typically says to his students is, why be yourself if you can be someone interesting?
I need that on a t-shirt, because that is kind of how I live my life. Like,
which is pretty audacious. And even seasoned poets who recognize that the speaker is not always a biographical eye would get sucked into his poem. So at a certain point, there's this story that he tells about a celebration. I can't remember if he turned 80 or 70. There's some celebration. And so they wanted to bring in all things Michigan. So someone called him up and said, we want to order some of those cookies that are shaped like mittens, you know, because he's from Michigan. Mm-hmm. He said, what are you talking about? He said, you know, the ones. And then they finally said, you know, the poem, the ones that you talk about in that poem, where do you buy them? And he just looked down and said, you kidding me? I just made that up.
So he's created a whole industry.
Yeah, there are a lot of stories like that. Another way to think about this might be to quote Marianne Moore, who says poetry is, and you know this definition, imaginary gardens with real toads in them. Mm. So what I find in my work is that there's almost always some autobiographical dimension, but there's also some fictionalizing. So I try to find a question, a burr under the saddle, so to speak, and then I follow the language and the patterns and the drama to get a good poem. And most of us have pretty mundane lives. And if we simply transcribed literally what happened, it would be like Job, right? I mean, the story would be true, but not emotionally satisfying. So I'm happy to take license with experience. But again, I find that most of my poems work best when they're a mix of those things. Mm-hmm. And I really don't worry about this too much with my students. I suppose if they were inventing things whole cloth and sort of tromping on other people's space, I mean, certainly there's a place where you don't want to colonize other people's space and so forth.
Right.
But for the most part, I think it just takes care of itself. You know, I think that the example that you mentioned with your friend or the person in your cohort, I think is somewhat rare. And in a way, it's a tribute to her success, right?
I mean, I wasn't convinced. So she did a good job.
So I don't worry about it too much, actually. I have the luxury. If I were writing about Joseph Smith, it would be another matter.
Right. Can't just, well, I don't know. Zach, you want to talk about making stuff up about Joseph Smith?
I certainly do make some stuff up. I will say, though, Lance, you know, I read a few of your poems aloud to some of my family members, and I think the one that they like the best is one that I suspect is entirely yours and is among the most mundane situations in the collection. It's lap swim at rec center pool, 2:07 p.m.
That's probably 90%. I mean, I haven't looked at it, but it's probably 90-95% true. There might be a few details.
Sure. I mean, and even if it's not 100% true, right? Bless leaky bladders during kiddie lessons, and the chlorine the punk lifeguard dumps in afterwards to even things out. Bless these buoys making me mayor of my own shimmery country, right? Like these are lines that transform the mundane into something transcendental and provide a new lens on what might seem otherwise unexceptional experience. And that, I think, is part of the magic in the collection that you've shared with us.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I agree. I was actually really curious. This thought specifically occurred to me when I was reading the poem In a Scruffy Grove, which I thought was kind of a nod to the sacred grove. But this boy speaker who is has some problems, and so I don't know if you recall, like, the speaker is a young boy who is meeting his friend, and his friend is showing him his collection of pee in a bottle in the backyard, and it gets really kind of disturbing. And so then the question is that based on real life? Or
I had a friend. I had a friend who showed me his bottle. I mean, I guess one could make
names have been changed to protect the guilty.
You're right.
I don't have enough of imagination that I would have thought that up. I just thought this is a story that no one would bother with. So therefore, maybe I'll bother with it.
Yeah.
And there was a class thing going on, too. His father was a doctor and kind of more well-to-do. And anyway, it was just an intriguing thing. I'd have to reread it to know exactly where it goes. But no, I remember him showing me where he hid it in this woodpile. And anyway, just went from there.
Yeah.
Strange things happen in southern Idaho.
Well, and everywhere.
And everywhere. You're right.
Yeah. I have not been able to make the leap yet, if it's something to aspire to just completely fabricate things. I tend to write based on, oh, this little thing happened, or my daughter said something. I'm going to write it down later, you know, think through it. So, I mean, everything in my book is based on something that really happened. There was even a poem about, I was writing about my grandmother, and I learned this incident from reading my father's journal. But she came to visit and help my mom when I was a baby, and she was a smoker. My grandparents were not LDS. And so she would go outside to smoke, and the door would be left open. And my father said something to her about how, I don't know the exact words, but it was basically that it was not appropriate for her to be smoking. And she had come all this way to help out with the family. And what was interesting was that, this is the part where I actually now I can't even remember it, the fiction and the reality is merged in my own head. I wrote a poem in which I recalled personally that she would kiss people on the mouth as like a greeting. There are, you know, some people who do that. And I remember that that was something she would do. And so I'm like, oh, I need to combine this together into a poem where he takes her to the airport and she gives him a kiss on the mouth. And it was, you know, a kiss of the smoke. And it was kind of her way of getting back at him for being kind of self-righteous. But there are very few poems like that where I just kind of make something up. But it did make a better poem, I will say. Together.
Just to clarify, Liz, then, were you actually saved by a truck driver in the middle of the road?
That is actually true. That is, like, in our family lore, my parents lived on a highway, and one afternoon, my mom hears a knock at the door, and it's a truck driver, and he's holding me by the hand and said, "Is this your little girl?" She was out, like, playing near the highway, and he had pulled over, and of course, as a mom, thinking on that moment, just feeling so horrified at the almost, you know, what might have happened. So that was definitely something I needed to write about in terms of how that would have impacted her. No, that really happened.
it was quite a dramatic, poetic narrative that you put together. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, well, thank you. I do like the revision process and the how can I shape this into something that impacts the reader in the way that I kind of want it to. So we've kind of talked a little about theology, but I wanted to kind of switch over and talk a little bit more about that, how that shows up. Zach, I wanted to hear from you, maybe some of the more specifics about, how you put together this epic, and I was curious about how long it's taken for you to create this. And of course, involving so much scholarship. And I'm assuming that you might have had to put it down and then take it back up since you've authored all these other books. And how does your LDS faith play into the way that you make those choices? And I guess particularly in relation to, you know, orthodoxy, are you concerned that your readers will be put out or put off by the way that you've treated the subject? That's a lot of questions there. Sorry.
There's a few different things in there. The first thing I'll say is that to the process of composition, you're right. I've primarily worked as a scholar throughout the course of my career. And part of the reason that it took me 20 years is that this has always been a side project. I would write 3 to 5 lines a day, pretty consistently, but that was it.
Wow.
And so that's a lot of days. And, you know, there were certainly periods in my life, say when I was finishing up another manuscript or, I don't know, dealing with the death of my father or other, you know, moments where, you know, it would just get lost for months and even years. But 3 to 5 lines a day when I could get them was about what I, the pace at which I worked on this project. And so it's been a long time coming. In terms of, the theology, let me back up actually and say that, one of the reasons I felt it was important to write this project is that, when you think about, literary tradition, there are very few genres that, can establish a lineage or a genealogy or insert a culture and a text into a larger conversation, right? We publish so many books that, we live in a moment where attention is fractured and it's hard to assemble all of the pieces into a coherent cultural picture. But epic poetry is one of those places, right? Where you can still, identify the ways in which epicists are talking to one another and have, continued that conversation over the course of decades and centuries. And so that's part of the reason that it was important to me that it wasn't, say, a novel, right? Because I could do a lot of the same work in a novel.
Sure.
Novels don't necessarily speak back and forth in conversation in the way that epic poems have done. And so my audience or my imagined audience in this project is not just Latter-day Saints, but those who are engaged in and invested in those sorts of larger literary conversations. And I know that because I'm writing both for people who are intimately familiar with the story of Joseph Smith and who believe in his divine calling as a prophet of the Restoration, and for those who are not members of the church and might think of him as someone who's deluded or someone who is deluding others, that almost no matter what I write, somebody is going to be unhappy about it.
Yeah, that's true. I'm
very confident about that. I don't know exactly which lines are going to make which people unhappy, but I feel very confident somebody is going to be unhappy at some point with something that I wrote.
Right. Hence the introduction where you say, okay, I know that you're not going to like this part, but just take it with a grain of salt. And
I mean, and so my desire has just been to write the best poem I could and to tell the story as faithfully as I could. And by faithfully, I don't mean that this is your Sunday school poem, right? That is going to promote answers. If it was your Sunday school poem, we probably wouldn't spend quite so much time with the demon erotica, right?
Right.
It's told in such a way that it is true to my understanding, both of the gospel and of human nature. You know, I know what it's like to be someone who tries really hard to do what you understand God asks you to do and to fail, and to fail through your own, you know, fallibility and weaknesses and shortcomings. And so it's easy for me to imagine, you know, a Joseph Smith who loses his temper, a Joseph Smith who, you know, misunderstood the divine communication, a Joseph Smith who gave priority to light things. And, you know, that's a Joseph Smith who shows up in the poem, as well as the Joseph who you know, exercises extraordinary faith and does some pretty incredible things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I appreciated your literary allusions and how you talked about that the poem is in conversation with other epicists. And so just some of the allusions: Dante, Pilgrim's Progress, Moby Dick, C.S. Lewis, of course. And I even caught the Where the Red Fern Grows allusion because I'm actually currently reading the book to my 11-year-old. So I really enjoyed that, reading about that.
I know that I did it, but I can't even remember what it is.
It's the raccoon sticks his hand into the log and then can't get the shiny piece of tin out again.
Okay.
Yes, I was like, oh, that's very delightful. I even told my son about it. Look, see, we're reading this book and now you'll be prepared for other future allusions. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, I was very impressed with some of those. And as we, try and come at a text from a paradigm of viewing our church leaders as human, I think is always really helpful. To grant that space for foibles, I think is important. I think we're kind of getting close to time. I did want to leave time for us to read something from our work. But I wanted to ask you, Lance, again about how theology shows up in your work. I read that you had mentioned that this collection seems to address theology a little bit more than your others. But I mean, I feel like it's still very subtle. It's almost like it shows the desire for a theology more than an actual theology. And I was reminded of Christian Wyman's work, who I really love. And he, as an academic, and he teaches at the Harvard Divinity School, he once said, "I have no illusions about adding to sophisticated theological thinking, but I think there are a ton of people out there who are what you might call unbelieving believers, people whose consciousness is completely modern and yet who have this strong spiritual hunger in them. I would like to say something helpful to those people." And I love how he approaches that. That's kind of a perspective I try and take as I write about religion or spirituality in my work. But I wanted to ask you, in relation to that idea, where do you fall in this spectrum in terms of your personal theologies that you might have curated and how it might show up in your work?
Yeah, great question. I consider myself a part of that camp, certainly. I anticipated this question and looked up a quote which I can never quite get by heart. And since we've already mentioned C.S. Lewis, this is especially apropos. Okay. So this is from the Screwtape Letters, which I read right after my mission as a young academic, and it has stayed with me ever since. He says this, of course, remember this is Screwtape, a senior devil, telling a junior devil, I think it's his nephew, how to tempt humans. Mm-hmm. He says, "Humans are amphibians, half spirit and half animal. As spirits, they belong to the eternal world, but as animals, they inhabit time." And I think in a way, when I'm sitting down to write a poem, that's my theology. I want to write a poem that's true to both impulses. And if you simply write about spiritual, otherworldly things, the poem will almost never land. It won't get any traction. And if you only if you only write about this world, there can often be a poem can become a slog. So I'm interested in toggling between those two worlds over and over again. I guess I'm interested in being true to a specific moment. I think of my poems being in conversation with other poems always, and I don't worry about where those poems come from, whether they're written by a Catholic, a non-believer, or a Buddhist. I'm just interested in the authenticity of the moment. So that's probably as close as I get to a theology.
Hmm.
Can I ask a follow-up question, Lance?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a moment in your poem, Crickets Churring,
okay,
which I loved, where you're talking about ways in which we acquiesce to difficult things. And you write, a wasp lays her eggs inside a swaying caterpillar on my porch, so her children will wake to a little snack, and I let her. And angels let her, and wings and instinct and a short summer conspire to let her. And as I read that, just, you know, we've been talking about illusions, I couldn't help but think of that passage in Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, where she's writing about how parasitic winged insects like wasps comprise 10% of the world's species. And, you know, talks about it as a devil's tithe. And, you know, how could we, you know, believe in God, essentially, given this multitude of horrors that comprise the insect world? Did you have Dillard in mind? You know, is I read it almost as a response to that. But I was
interesting.
Just curious.
I did not have that passage in mind. The one that I'm more familiar with is where she watches a small frog being devoured by some underwater beetle that essentially injects an enzyme and liquefies its bones. And then anyway, so that's maybe even more ghoulish. So in this poem, I say, let her, if this were in real life, I probably wouldn't let the wasp do it. But in the poem I did, and I don't have an easy answer to that. I mean, you're absolutely right. How can we make sense of a world where, you know, what does Tennyson say? The nature read something like that. I can't reconcile that exactly. I mean, maybe I could intellectually, but emotionally I can't. So I don't think about it too much. Mm. One of the contradictions, one of the paradoxes we wrestle with, right?
Yeah, I think that's why I like poetry so much as a vehicle for spirituality, because it doesn't try to reconcile those tensions and those contradictions. And in approaching theology specifically, I really appreciate Keats's idea of negative capability, that we don't have to try and, you know, reconcile those things. I don't think we even have to try and reconcile the cognitive dissonance in church history. It's okay for this to be true and this to maybe be true. And so creating a theology based on your personal experiences and what you've learned in your body, I think is really invaluable. I know that's how I kind of navigate some of the more troubling things is, you know, I have a history, personal history, a family history of really beautiful experiences that really ground me. And so I feel like that's how literature can help us with religion also. I wanted to take a minute and have each of us maybe read something from our books. As we're kind of wrapping up here, Zach, would you like to choose something to read? Maybe I know that there are sections of rhetoric that are hard to kind of pull out of context. So maybe if there's something that you feel drawn to share.
I think I'll do okay, especially given the discussion we've been having about unresolved questions and unresolved challenges. I'll read from the end of book three in the poem, which is a moment right after Alvin's death. And, you know, this is a real challenge, or I imagine it as a tremendous challenge, not only in terms of interpersonal loss for Joseph, who didn't yet understand anything about baptism for the dead, didn't yet understand anything about the nature of a post-mortal existence, and who had been told that he was supposed to bring his brother with him to help retrieve the plates the next year by Moroni. You know, for me, I wanted to experience, and for readers to experience, something of the disorientation of that loss. And so this is the way that the first half of the poem, the first volume of the poem, ends, in irresolution, in a lack of clarity. Right after Alban's funeral, the reverend preached in charity from John, "I am the resurrection and the life." But Joseph was not comforted and stayed behind to share his doubts with Alvin. "How could he have let you die? It isn't fair. You said you'd come with me September, and Moroni said, I have to bring you with me. What am I supposed to do? Dig up your bones and haul them to Cumorah?" Here he paused, expectantly, as though the Witch of Endor might at any moment raise his brother from the turf to answer these complaints. Of course, she didn't. Peace of mind, like any other peace, is always free, but seldom cheap. So Joseph struggled on. "Did I mishear?" No. When he spoke in English, and his terms for taking up the plates were unambiguous. Could he have been mistaken? Angels are just men, made perfect. Maybe his infallibility is pending, still in progress. If Moroni can't be trusted, though, what grounds have I for seeking to retrieve the plates? That way lies madness. Every gift is good that comes from God, in whom there is no slant or swerving. Surely, then, his messenger must also be beyond reproach. What else? Perhaps I've sinned, offended God, and he revoked my high commission. Have my sins made you expendable in some divine arithmetic, remaindered, while I yet remain to languish here below? Such thoughts are insupportable. Take pity on me, Lord. Deliver me from grief and doubt. And so doubt is where we end in that section.
That was a beautiful reading. I think I would have enjoyed reading it much more if you just need the audio version. But I think that really does.
I need to submit the request to the University of
Illinois. We'll have dialogue on top of that. Thank you. Lance, do you have one that you would prefer to read?
So maybe I'll read that last one. I first wanted to say I love the way that Blank Verse holds that collection together, your collection.
Yeah, it's really nice.
And I can't remember whether it was Frost or another early modernist who said something like, "We admire the straight crookedness of a good walking stick." And he was describing iambic pentameter. And you've embodied that in your reading. So. So this is Quail Egg, the last poem of the collection. We talked about historicity and what you make up, et cetera. In real life, I found two eggs, bird eggs, and put them both in my mouth.
Oh.
But I knew no one would believe that. So, so I lied and said it was only one.
Just request before you start reading, Lance, that you give us clarity at the end about whether or not the ending is, in fact, true to life as well.
Quail egg. "While watering, I found it under the ponderosa pine. A stray egg, already cold, dropped by a stray hen in a hurry for better cover. A thing like that, you have to save. But my PJs had no pockets, so I polished it on my sleeve and popped it into the wet pouch of my mouth for safekeeping. Its shell tasted like calcium, like sun, which is to say, like nothing at all. I moved that oval prayer cheek to cheek, and even the names of my hostas, stained glass, blue angel, fire and ice, seemed to bear witness to a new magnetic north. Was the egg fertilized? Should I call it a compass? Cook it in bacon fat? I felt old as an alderman, young as rain. And for a moment, oppositions held. Tame, feral, spirit, flesh. Me, not me. Snail, sky. Then Jackie called from the kitchen for me to grab a ripe peach or two in the world wrinkle. I answered in a nothing voice, like the groggy man she'd kissed awake at dawn, but already I could taste funerals on my tongue, wings unfolding at my back.
That's just such a great image to end on, in light of the way that you framed the collection, that, you know, even focusing on our bodily experience doesn't, you know, preclude us from having those wings. So I love that.
To answer Zach's questions, yes, they are literal wings. I have pictures to prove it. I'll send them later.
No, not that part. Not that part.
Okay.
I read it as that you had accidentally bit into.
No.
Oh, the funeral. Okay.
Funerals on your tongue.
Oh, wow. No, I didn't think of it. That's a better reading. I'm going to steal that. I'm going to say, yes, I ended up biting the egg by accident.
Especially given the way that earlier in the collection, you talk about challenges with fertility, and you have that question, was the egg fertilized? That funeral's on my tongue. I was just gutted when I finished that collection.
Yeah.
When I do my next Q&A, can I have you next to me and I'll have you answer the, I love that symmetry. Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. It's funny, I wasn't wondering which one I would read, and I think I've picked something that kind of fits some of these motifs a little bit. I'm going to read a poem that's at the end of my collection called Eve at 87, which I'm just fictionalizing, what Eve, and kind of modernizing what Eve would have thought about in retrospect for her life. So it's called Eve at 87. And it has an epigraph after Toni Morrison's Eve Remembering. I remember still the reedy ache, like the saxophone's need, swelling the tiled underground inside me. Again, I'd say if you asked, to swallow every seed, to know the juice of anything. That story, like an old billboard, its words now bleached to papery skin in need of sloughing. Oh, what I know of God is not without the gavel, not merely its wooden crack, but what I know of the hand, the slick meat swell of lambing, pink of my own cheek and the worm's wet body, the pine's promiscuity in spring chartreusing the world, the aspen's bony fractals lacing the face of the mountain, autumn strumming its amber ballads, summer fields frothing with milkweed, the old girls shaking out their hair. The ocean white with miles of herring milt and egg, seagull clamor hovering over glittering backs of their parents, the hunger in every gelded landscape. Oh, infinitely more. Could you dream what is past the carnival of temporary outbuildings, the trailers of belief? What lush grasses await? What whispers there? What other prayers you haven't yet mouthed, even for the grip of shards? A hard snow, you too could bloom past a theory of fruit. What is one paper bag's quarrel with the wind against the river's muscling, its endless desire, when every mouthless vine that seeks the light is a prayer, when even the vulture, wearing her blackened grief, redeems the armadillo?
I love that ending.
Thank you.
Chartreusing. I'm sure that has never been done before.
Okay.
And Alan and Tara.
Well, it happens all over the South.
I love it. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, thank you for joining me today and sharing your work with us and your thoughts. And I hope that our readers will find where they can get these books and maybe carry with them some of the paradigm of how to think about theology in a different way and how literature might help them with that. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.